And just before the plane came to a stop.
Right. That it? Just before the plane came to a stop, we had a pipeline coming in that was close to the surface from a port on the Adriatic, and that was the way we were getting all of our fuel. And they weren't close to our storage tanks, which weren't very big. That's why we had the pipeline. But the B-24 broke the pipeline, and before we could get communications back to the pumping stations that were feeding that line, we must have lost maybe 50,000 gallons worth of high octane gasoline without a fire, which no one in their right mind would ever say is possible. It can't happen. If it would have happened just seconds sooner, you know, the sparks that I told you about that were made by the plane coming in on a metal strip, they couldn't even tell it was a metal strip. From where they were, we didn't have time to talk about things like that. It looked like it was all grass, but a hard stone base. But the whole command area found it absolutely unbelievable that a B-24 could land in a fighter strip and just go off the strip enough to break the our pipeline and not have a horrible fire. Fortunately, it wasn't a cold day when there were fires and tents and things like that. But, you know, 50, 60,000 gallons of gasoline is pouring on the ground. We had a hazardous condition there for a long time after the miracle of no fire happened. Anyway, there was one of the crewmen that was critically injured there, and we were able to save them all and get them all the help they needed, and they, best of our knowledge, they all survived. The plane was an absolute disaster. It wasn't worth fixing anymore, so we robbed it for parts and sent them back to the depot. The parts would be reused. But that was the closest shave I ever had in the war. We were in a lot of air raids, but nothing as positive as the complete destruction of our base would have been if that gasoline had caught fire. It's just one of those things that happens once in a blue moon, and as I talk back about it now, if somebody else was telling me the story, I would think that it's an exaggerated impossibility to have 100 octane gas is more volatile than 80 octane that you use in automobiles. We used it for dry cleaning carefully.
Right? Tell about the newsletter sent to the Jewish men from Marion during the war.
My brother Milt was married already, and he wasn't ushered into the service, so he took over the local B'nai B'rith Bulletin Committee, and he had communications from all of the servicemen from our Jewish community in Marion, and at the same time kept track of all the spouses and relations and family on the other end, and brought it all together into a delightful paper that we all look forward to receiving, because, you know, we all found about one another. We all found out the APO, the post office box number. And in this next issue that I got after this story that I just related to you, there was a write-up about Max Gans and Frank Maidenberg meeting in Tunis and how that all happened. And he kept up a communication there that he talked about when Willie Glogus had a younger son. Willie Glogus, remember, from the shoe store? He had a younger son, Bobby, who I think was 19 years old and was lost in one of the early battles shortly after the landings across the channel. And that was the first we had known about him. No, wait a minute, that's not right. That was Bobby Simons, the son of the local merchant, Phil Simons in Marion. Bobby Simons was in the B-24 wing that was the south of us, not the same wing that lost the plane, but he was lost in one of the B-24 accidents that was bombing the Ploesti oil fields in that area. Anyway.
What was Nan doing during the war when you were in Europe?
Well, her being back home was very helpful, of course, for her parents in the traumatic period they had just gone through, and she was involved in helping on various and sundry civic matters. She didn't go get a job, but she helped out in various charitable matters that to keep busy. She liked to read and keep up with things, and she wrote me a letter every day. And of course, that took some time, you see. But the days do drag on very slowly in a situation like that. I guess you know, sometimes the 2.5 years that I was overseas seemed like 10 years, and sometimes it seemed like 10 months. So it's hard to describe.
How did the war affect your father's business?
Not a great deal. His business seemed to go along pretty good because most industries in and around the area were moving along pretty good, and some involved the war effort and some didn't. But I think that all in all, it's safe to say that it was less of a strain and risk for them than the Depression years in the mid-30s.
Tell about being reunited with Nan after the war.
Well, I came in to a base in southern Indiana, Camp Atterbury, where the families and Nan reasoned things out very clearly, and she alone came to greet me. And we stayed there for about 24 hours, and then drove back to Marion. And at that time, I had returned to this country for after 2.5 year absence. But at that time, I was only here for a 30-day period. A 30-day leave, accrued leave time, and then to report to someplace in Georgia where our unit was to be reactivated for immediate departure, immediate as possible, for the Far East. And that is about the time that the first atomic bomb was dropped and things began to change. And then by the time the second one was dropped, our urgency to go to the Far East was dropped, and the whole thing changed, everything changed.
What was life like after the war in the early days of your marriage?
After the war in the early days of my marriage, well, the early days of my marriage passed overseas, but we immediately commenced to look for a home to live in, because I wasn't very anxious, and neither was Nan, to live with her folks where we were living when I first came back. And we were very lucky, and within a... of course, you know, you said after the war, because the war, I wasn't out of the army yet at that point, but it was a couple months after the second atomic bomb was dropped that they commenced to release units like us. And it was a happy reuniting of families and friends and efforts, and we were very fortunate in finding a home that we were able to buy and fix up and move into, and that's when our married life really started, because as nice as my in-laws were, and they couldn't have been nicer, you know, you want privacy and you want to be in your own home, and we had that within a matter of months after I got back, and then our marriage got underway, you might say.
Describe your first house.
It was a four-bedroom home that we bought for $15,000, and it was located right near the hospital on Euclid Avenue. And people said, "My God, what are you going to do with four bedrooms?" Well, we made one into a den. We used one for a storage room. We used one for the master bedroom, and had one spare room, so it worked out fine, and we were lucky to get it. Of course, today, a home probably would be $100,000, We bought it for $15,000. Maybe spent $7,000 or $8,000 fixing it up the way we wanted it. So we were very fortunate. And then in 1960, we moved and we built a home that our dream home, and lived there for 20 years before Nan's tragedy. So, and I still live there. We built a home there that, that after we took our time building it because we weren't in a hurry. And after we got it all built, the architect asked us, what would you do different if you were taking over? And the only thing we could think of was we'd move a couple light switches. So we planned it pretty well. When Ann wanted to know what size, she didn't understand dimensions, and when I told her the living room was 18 by 20 or whatever it was, I stopped doing that and I waited until I found her room. Now, you remember you asked me about the dining room? Okay, here's a room that's almost exactly that size. And that's what we did it, and it was fun. And but we didn't make very many mistakes. She wanted a lot of storage space, and we got a lot of storage space. And really, the early answer about the only thing we'd want to change would be the location of a few light switches is by right. Because all we have is a two-level home with two bedrooms on the lower level. The lower level is sufficiently remote from the rest of the house that if you don't use it, it doesn't affect the traffic patterns of the rest of the house. So after, when we had three kids, of course, it was great. But after the kids left, we just practically cut off those two bedrooms, used them for guests, and there was a TV and a playroom there for kids. So it worked out great. It was well planned all the way from the standpoint of family through college.
What was the best thing about being married those first few years?
Well, when you're married and you practically leave within a matter of weeks, because the time that I went to OCS for 90 days, Nan got to visit me once, and that was it. So I really didn't have much of a married life before, but we certainly had enough of a married life before to make sure that we both wanted to get back to married life. We were very fortunate. We had a very happy marriage all the way through. We had our differences occasionally, like everybody else does, but we always communicated through them and had a wonderful 37-year marriage. 37 years, that's not peanuts either, is it?
Yeah.
When I got back, of course, it was a lot better coming back married and having men to come back to and us to get together than to have done it the other way around and not gotten married because of the war or anything. But I think it worked out good. Our planning was sheer perfection. We didn't want to start a family, and that was smart. We did want to get married, and that was smart. And so we picked up sort of where we left off and took life easy for a few weeks and made a few trips. We went to Virginia Beach for a holiday trip and rode bicycles all over the place, and maybe that set the groundwork for the miscarriage, but we're never sure about that. We always talked about that as a possibility, but in any event, it was no great earth-shaking thing, and we had a lot of experiences to talk about, a lot more than I've had to talk about here that I recollect, but whenever I wrote letters home and whenever I sent pictures home, they were predominantly on the subject of what food package I'd received, and the pictures were eating someplace, picnicking, because, you know, what else could you write about? You're going to say that our troops went to, or our planes went to so-and-so today or something like that. One thing that I rarely ever mention, I'm in the warehousing, industrial warehousing business. And, of course, in the Army, I was in Air Corps Supply. But a sort of an interesting aside, again, about the economics of war, and I rarely ever mention it, very few people even know about it. But during the time that I was the Air Corps Supply Officer in the 35th Division, the 83rd Air Service Squadron, the 38th Air Service Group, we had a a competitive chart. Our job was to keep all the planes flying. They were shipping planes to the Far East, they were shipping planes to Europe and to Africa, and the name of the game for our kind of unit was to keep all of the aircraft without AOCs. An AOC in the Army meant an aircraft out of duty for a day. That's the yardstick. Our unit had the best AOC record of the entire 35th Air Service Command. And for this, I was awarded a Bronze Star Medal, which I've kept in the drawer and tucked away because I thought all units should be doing what we did, and I didn't think it was worthy of a medal. I'm not belittling the medal, but I'm just talking about the economics of war. What did we do? When we had an aircraft here that was down for a supercharger, and we had an aircraft over here that was down for a wheel, and we had an aircraft over here that was down for a Fisteris on the dry side or whatever, if we had to work into the night, we kept crews on those planes that were waiting for parts. We stole parts off of the other one to get two of them flying so that all the parts when they come in were put on one plane. You know, that doesn't take any great intellect, does it? It just takes a little bit of willingness to put forth a little extra effort. So where other units had 7 and 8 AOCs a day, we were frequently without an AOC and frequently with 1 or 2 down, depending again on where the parts had to come from. Now, there was a big Air Force depot in Bari, in the southern part of Italy. And we would make frequent visits there, and frequently we found out that it was before the days of prolific use of computers, and frequently they didn't know what all they had there, because when these supply ships came in and they unloaded them helter-skelter, they tried to keep a good record of it, but for the most cases they had amateurs doing record-keeping and everything, and invariably we'd go through that depot, which was the largest Air Force depot in the world at the time, in Bari, Italy. And we would find things that we've been waiting for a long time that they said they didn't have. We would find them. Well, probably weren't any other units that did that. They weren't that audacious or something, I guess. But it's all part of the economics of war. The fact that they had to award a medal to somebody for something that everybody should have been doing, I found rather repugnant, because we had to find a better way to do things, you know. But as I said, we felt a little better about it when we found out that the much heralded efficiency of the great German army had the same damn problems we did, and they were just as blundered as we were.
Let's talk a little bit more about National China.
By the time Leroy Weinberg and I split up, and I stayed in Marion, and he opened in Lansing, Michigan, and we departed from the discussions with the guy in Fort Wayne that we didn't like, who wanted to buy us out. About that time, my brother Milt had finished school and was working in Chicago, and for Marshall Field and Company. And interestingly enough, he wound up managing their china and glass department. And when they had any closeouts that they were offered people to get rid of, I found out about him early, and we bought, he sent us down some stuff. And anyway, make a long story short, Milt didn't know if he wanted to get into the business we were developing, into the hotel and restaurant equipment business predominantly at that time. And Milt got a year's leave of absence from Marshall Field and came down and joined the business when the business was just beginning to get its feet on the ground and flourishing. And we started to build a hotel and restaurant equipment business that went on. A few years later, we asked my brother Meyer, who was then in Akron, Ohio, managing a shoe store or something, to come down and join us, and then we had three of us in there, and that was in the late 30s, and Meyer came down and joined just about the time that I had to leave for the Army, so it worked out pretty good. And then when I came back, gradually after getting settled down from getting reacquainted with my wife and a few things like that, I went to work, went back to work in National China. And I stayed in that business until about 1960. And then I pulled out, and then later my brother, Meyer, had already retired, and Milt has been retired and lives in Marion and getting on fine.
What was it like working with your brothers?
Pretty much like any family. For the most part, we got along pretty good, but there were times when we had differences that were very difficult to overcome. But when all three of us were interested enough in a subject to vote, we had no problem, because, you know, you can't cut three into half. You got to have two out of three. So that's the way we always operated. But when one brother vacillated and couldn't make up his mind, why, we would run into a few problems once in a while, but nothing insurmountable.
How did the business change through the years?
How did it change? It changed primarily from retail china and glass and gift items and things like that into a hotel restaurant supply house. And we were selling and designing kitchens and betting on kitchen installations for hospitals and hotels and institutions like that. So it changed completely from the retail china glass to hotel and restaurant ware, which is really an entirely different field than the domestic field. And you have a very severe limitation on the retail arena in a small town, but in the restaurant. But in the restaurant end of it, there was no limit to our growth, because we went all over the state and hired representatives to call in restaurants and hotels, bars, and then sent out trucks and handled the installation of kitchen installations in universities and hospitals, and grew into a pretty big business.
Did you enjoy that work?
Mm-hmm.
And since your involvement with National China, what have you been doing?
I used to do a little industrial warehousing on the side, even when I was with National China, because I sort of liked that. I went almost full-time into industrial warehousing and buying old industrial properties and fixing them up and renting them for warehousing or for small industries, things like that. And I'm still doing that.
How does this compare for you to your work with National China? Is it as gratifying?
I think they were both were. I think when I left National China, we were getting to have a few too many disagreements, and I figured the two brothers and one business was enough, and I figured I wasn't really doing any injustice to pulling out at that time. And then I got involved with a group that built a Holiday Inn in Marion, and I continued to expand my activities in the commercial industrial real estate and doing what I'm doing today. But I've been pretty fortunate, I guess, to have always been involved in doing the kind of things that, like Pop said, that you like to do most.
Let's talk now about your children. Do you remember how you felt when you first learned you would be a parent?
Yeah, I felt pretty proud and pretty happy and pretty curious and a whole lot of things. And I think we had a pretty good arrangement. Nan and I always talked over what we planned ahead, and Nan kept in close touch with the teachers in school, and we watched the kids' education and tried to do for our kids what our parents had done so well for both of us, and worked out real nice. Raising children, as we all know, is no simplistic task. It's a very complex and complicated one, and people that think it's just a matter of feeding and clothing them have sure got a lot to learn.
When was Tony born?
Tony was born in 1947, April the 6th.
Who was he named after?
He was Anthony Charles, A.C. His middle name came from Nanette's side of the family. Her maiden name was Coran. So, but I don't think there was any particular reason for the Tony Anthony part, except that we both liked it, and on the basis of popular names of the day, that's the way we did it.
What was Tony like as a baby?
Well, you'd think that we would have spoiled him, but he was really a pretty nice little baby, and we didn't have much problem with him at all. He was just a real good baby, just like he's today a real good son. And he's the politician in our family, as you know, and loved by everybody that knows him.
Is there a story you can tell about him as a young child?
Well, interesting. There is one interesting tidbit. When he had to write a paper in high school, like kids do, you know, about what you'd like to be or what you'd like to do, he had decided early in high school that he'd like to go away to school without having made a decision as to what he's going to study in school at that point. But he'd like to go away to school and then come back and be mayor of Marion, which he did. So I thought that was an interesting decision to make at that point.
When was David born?
And David was born in 51, I think. No, yeah, 51. I don't know. I'm not sure. But in any event, David and Tony were pretty close to each other, and they got along pretty good, but once in a while they would get into a knockdown and drag him out. And I remember once it got so serious that quiet David was egged on just a little bit too far, and he kicked a hole in Tony's bedroom door, and we knew that he had to be pretty mad about something, because it's not easy to kick a hole in that door. But generally speaking, that was very much the exception. They got along pretty good, and Jill wasn't born until some almost 10 years after David. She was born in 56, and I remember sending some, about that time is when My Fair Lady was a hit on Broadway, and we wired our relations and everybody around the country that we now have our own Fair Lady.
What was she like as a young child?
Well, she was very nice. I remember seeing a picture of her at a very young age trimming the meat off of a rib bone. And she was a good eater, and she started out like a chubby little gal, believe it or not, and good eater. And I don't recall that we had any serious problems with any of our three kids, which may be saying a nice thing about the parents. I don't know. I take a little credit, I suppose, someplace along the line.